Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Here in the third hour, Dr. Harold Tomasz will be our guest. We're going to be talking with him about St. Timothy and Titus, putting most of the focus on St. Timothy, simply more to be known there. And then Brian Gadawa, a screenwriter from Southern California, a regular guest and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment, will join us as usual this time of the year when the Academy Award nominations come out. Brian comes on over and we talk about the nominations, and later, of course, when the Oscars are actually awarded, we'll talk with him again about that. Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ was nominated for a few minor categories. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 didn't get a single nomination. Of course, he did not submit it in the documentary category. So we'll find out what's going on and the films that did get major nominations. We'll talk about some of those with Brian Gadawa in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Before we begin our conversation on St. Timothy and Titus, I was mentioning the fact that these two saints are, of course, pastors. Paul is an apostle, but he's writing to Timothy and then later to Titus, young pastors, pastors in the church. I don't know how old Timothy was. I know that we've got accounts of Timothy traveling with Paul at certain times. Maybe he was a very young man. I don't know how old you had to be a pastor in those days. Nowadays, it takes a seminary education, doesn't it? And it's a good idea. But planning for that can begin a lot earlier. You may have a son or a grandson or know of someone who's a high school-aged young man who you think might be a good pastor. I want you to put them on to Christ Academy 2005 on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. This is a two-week residential program during the summer for high school-aged men of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod who are interested in exploring what it takes to become a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. They spend 2 weeks on campus there at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. They interact with the faculty, with the students. They go to chapel. They go to classes. They see what seminary life is like, and they see what it might take by way of study to become a pastor. Christ Academy 2005. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. The logo for Christ Academy 2005 is there. You can click on it and find a direct link to everything you need to know, or you can call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, toll-free, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. Our website address again, issuesetc.org. Dr. Harold Tomasz is Associate Professor of Greek and the New Testament at Concordia University, Wisconsin, Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Tomasz, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be here.
Well, on Monday this week, the church remembered St. Timothy. Today, the church remembers St. Titus. These two books, or actually the three books, 1st and 2nd Timothy and then Titus together, along with a couple others, are called the pastoral epistles. And sometimes that puts people off. They don't know exactly what that means, or they think it's only for pastors. Clear up any confusion that there might be there about the books that bear the names of these two saints.
Well, those portions of Scripture are certainly meant for all Christians to read. They're inspired. They are helpful. I would suggest that to read them, however, requires additional insights and maybe another step or two in interpretation. Why do I say that? Because God has called men into the holy ministry, he places requirements upon them that sometimes he doesn't place on the rest of the church. For example, they must be husbands of one wife. They must be faithful. They must not be lovers of money given to alcohol or drink. And you can find other prescriptions in the New Testament about faithfulness and the like. And as you read these passages, Paul is largely instructing what seemingly are young men, both in Timothy and Titus, in his letters, in an effort to shape them to be pastors in the church. In some ways, it's very parallel to the kind of work that I do. Along with Dr. Mashke here at Concordia Mequon, we have some over 100 pre-seminary students. And on a day-to-day basis, I shape them over 3 years, along with my counterparts in the faculty. And we look at texts. We shape ideas. And they're not even at the seminary. They don't have a call, but they have an aspiration to the ministry. Let me say something about that. A number of years ago at Concordia Seminary in Edmonton, a very good friend of mine who was the president of the seminary said, I need to get children in kindergarten already to start thinking about the ministry, and I've got an idea. And what he said was, let's do a poster campaign with a young man starting at the age of 3. And this is, we took a picture of it was my son, and we took a picture of him naked from the waist up with microphones attached to him, and he was announcing with large glass frames that he intended to go to the seminary. Well, it was quite a hit, this poster campaign in the churches of Lutheran Church Canada. And the next year, we began to explore putting one poster into the congregations of our church to have young men explore the thought of ministry, much like you mentioned just before the program began with Christ Academy. And the second year, we placed the words of 2 Timothy 3:16 into the poster. Jordan was laying on some books. You could read the titles that were children's books related to accounts in both the Old and the New Testaments. And it says, remember that from early childhood you've known the scriptures which have made you and do make you wise unto salvation, which are good for reproof, for teaching, for instruction, for equipping the saints of God in every good work. And boy, that second year we started getting phone calls of moms and dads who said, what books are those? I've never seen them before. Are they a full, not encyclopedia, but a systematic presentation of our Christian faith done wonderfully for young people? And so a conversation began. In the third year, we had a picture of him, what are the requirements of a pastor? And we took the words of gentle, not a bully. And we interpreted Paul's words for younger men in the ministry to look at, and they, again, informing them over the office of the ministry. The fourth year had a very interesting twist. There was a synodical convention, and Jordan was invited as a young man to visit the convention. And the night before, we practiced. What's your favorite color? What languages are you learning? Do you like music? What's your favorite Bible character, and what do you want to be? And, of course, his color was red. His favorite animal was a horse, and he was learning German. He liked to play piano. And, of course, he wanted to be a pastor. But the next day at convention with hundreds and really almost 500 delegates and lights and sound, he froze. And they asked him, what's your favorite color? Green. What's your favorite animal? A dog. What's your favorite book of the Bible? And it was Genesis. What do you want to be? And he said, a fireman. Well, the place just broke up. But it was funny. And our pastor, seminary president, said, well, I guess we put out fires. And the next year, the poster read, what do you want to be, fireman or pastor? And the long and the short of the story is he is now in first year high school, and he's insatiable in terms of his knowledge, and he said he wants to be a pastor. Wow. It did take the experiences from early childhood. And so the following posters that we put into the hands of the church were needs nourishment. And we put them at a piano, and we put them in the context of friends, and those many gifts that go already years in advance into the making of a pastor. So let me return to Timothy. Timothy was a son of a Greek man and a faithful Jewish mother, had not been circumcised, but was through faithful women in his family, grandmother and mother, brought into the faith, prepared. And then Paul often speaks of Timothy as his son, my dear son, my beloved son, my son in the faith. And when it came time to, when this explosion of the confession of Jesus rippled from Jesus' own words into the church, first through the teaching of the apostles in that first decade after Christ's crucifixion, Timothy seems to have been part of that movement early on. And Paul then circumcises him in order, not under compulsion, by the way, which is really strange when you look at Galatians commentary, where there's this real debate whether anyone should be circumcised, but in order that Timothy could walk in the community of that early church. Let me stop there, but I'd like to talk a little bit about what sort of the experiences Timothy had and who his friends were in that early church period.
We're talking with Dr. Harold Thomas. St. Timothy and St. Titus is a focus today. Monday, the church remembered St. Timothy. Today, St. Titus, two pastors brought to us through the pen of St. Paul, and of course the books that bear their name. Dr. Harold Thomas is Associate Professor of Greek and of the New Testament at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin. If you have a question or a comment on St. Timothy or Titus, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What do we know of Paul's relationship then? He talks a lot about he will mention, as in the passage you referenced, the godly mother that Timothy lived with. What was Paul's relationship with Timothy?
I think it was twofold. I think Timothy certainly learned and was tutored in the faith and as a young pastor how to relate to congregations. If you look at Timothy at one point in chapter 4, verse 13 of his second book, Paul says, you know, bring my cloak, which I think might be a reference to his stole, his books and his parchments, and then he invited to come with him. But Timothy wasn't the only one, I believe, under Luke's tutelage. We have Demas, we have Crescens, we have Titus, we have Mark, we have Tychius. Paul is always sort of shaping these men in terms of not only the doctrine, which would be primary before them, but also in terms of the kinds of people he would meet in his congregation and the kinds of hardships they would face. Let's just take a look at 1 Timothy 5 through chapter 6. You know, he was to address and be pastor to young and old, to widows and church workers and elders, and even the construct of slaves in their day. And yet he is told of his pastoral duties, proclaiming truth, being a good minister of Christ. And especially, it seems, Timothy in particular had the gift of preaching. And so Paul says, don't forget that gift which was endowed on you with the laying on of hands. And I believe Timothy was faithful to that duty. And so when you look at his Paul's exhortations towards him, he talks on the one hand of following the good example that Paul had led, but then also in terms of the perilous times, what was at stake with his ministry. Let me give you a glimpse at this. When I turn to Acts chapter 20, for example, this is close to the third missionary journey, then the conclusion of it where Paul moves back to Jerusalem. He is part of a cohort that are accompanying Paul to Jerusalem with a large gift that the church had collected at the time. And we find out Sopater was there, Pyrrhus, Aristarchus, Secundus, and Gaius, still others, Timothy included in that list. And there's a very interesting illustration that while Paul preached that evening, it was late, so we can imagine it, I think, that Timothy was involved with the pastoral ministry right at the birth when the church moves from Sabbath services also to Sunday services. His circumcision also sort of confirms that wherever Paul went, Timothy seemed to follow, address concerns in those congregations, or take over the work from Paul and the like. And that man, there was a young man sitting in the window and listening to Paul preach late at night, and he fell from the window, and if you remember, Paul resuscitated him, brought him back to life. And Timothy was part of that experience that sort of met Sabbath-wise with the Jewish community, then in the evening would listen to Paul as they read and preached, and then Sunday morning culminated with words like, well, they broke bread. And then after they broke bread, Paul and the company departed. So it's an exciting time as the gospel explodes onto the horizon, first of the Jewish church and then to Gentiles who were part of that Jewish dispersion and are converted by Paul. And wherever Paul goes, it seems that Timothy is soon to follow. And wherever a church is born by Paul's witness, there is never a time where that young community isn't soon put into the hands of one of these pastors that Paul is shaping, such as Timothy. And we can see how he is then urge to hold to the gospel, the resoluteness of Christ's resurrection, and the strength that comes in the gospel.
The two letters to Timothy from St. Paul are just jam-packed with some of the most practical, and I mean in terms of good sound practice based upon sound teaching, practical advice for pastors ever given. They cannot be improved upon in any way whatsoever. And there are two things, you've mentioned one in an oblique way already, and another one that I want to get to. There are two things that stand out in Paul's exhortation to Timothy. One is, it just sticks out like a sore thumb in one of those epistles, where he just says to Timothy, preach the word. And then he expands upon that. Be ready, even when people don't want you to preach the word. Rebuke and exhort and correct. It sounds as though Paul is saying far more than to Timothy than just, you're a good preacher, you stick to that. It sounds as though he's giving a command, an institution of what every pastor ought to be first and foremost occupied with. Am I reading too much into it?
No, I don't think you are. I think sometimes, especially under the pressures of being a pastor in our day, there are, you know, so many things that young and certainly even experienced pastors face. And you focus in on what is to be the primary duty of the pastor. Well, this preaching of the word sometimes is very narrowly defined only in terms of the public ministry, but certainly I think it's much broader than that. When we apply a dialogue with our parishioners about confession or absolution or go into a confessional dialogue, or we're speaking about speaking to our parishioners, we're not only trying to alleviate, which is the stress in their lives, which a word like counseling evokes, and it's not a bad word, but I've had experiences with courts as a result of visiting prisoners and so on, and I know that under the laws of both the United States and Canada, a pastor is protected when he does what he is called to do, and that is to share God's word and to bring about the forgiveness of sins by his preaching, whether in the pulpit or on a private person-to-person level, correctly dividing the word of truth. So, and that word then is realized in the congregation, first in the community of the baptized. And certainly, when we look at what Paul is talking about with Timothy, he gives him instructions about what major teachings there are in the church. And oddly enough, you might be surprised at this. There's a portion of the scriptures where Timothy is mentioned in the book of Hebrews in the 13th chapter, where it says that Timothy has been released from prison. And the writer to the Hebrews, who is acquainted, probably one of the circle of friends I mentioned earlier, to Timothy, in the book of Hebrews, it talks about what these teachings are, the laying on of hands with regards to baptism, with regards to the atonement of Jesus. And he says, you should be teachers, master pastors by now. Do I need to go back to the fundamentals? And when the pastors spoke to one another this way, it seems that they encouraged. So Timothy is always in the company of other pastors. They realize their gifts and strengths one towards another, but this apostolic pattern which began with Jesus, say, in Matthew 10, where Peter is matched up with another disciple, and James and John and Simon the Zealot and Judas. I mean, you name the various combinations. They come in pairs. They are associated with one another. And it seems that when one is, if you will, under duress, the another one has strength. When one has a gift, the other one does not. They complement one another. And so I'm looking at 2 Timothy right now. There's exhortation to use his gift, to guard it, the hardship that he might suffer along with Paul, the failures that one might experience, and yet the faithfulness to which Timothy is called, the urgent duty, the glorious example. I mean, just looking through that, you see real-life ministry where two men who are serving the church understand forgiveness between themselves and also for the larger church. And so they are in a community of baptized, and the administration of the sacraments in particular seem to be foremost on their minds at various places. If you think of the book of Hebrews, it culminates in coming to the blood that speaks louder than Abel's blood. Well, this is the kind of language that the community around Timothy knew. They broke bread, as in Acts 20. They sought to go to the Passover. They were. It's interesting, Acts 20 begins with them on a Passover trip, and their destination some 50 days later hopes to be in Jerusalem with Pentecost. So even Paul and Timothy are mapping around their lives around the liturgical character of the Jewish community into which our Christian calendar has been born. And I call this the sacred bridge, and we're sort of privileged to look in at the relationship between Paul and Timothy at this time and see how much the actions of these men have had an impact on the explosion of the gospel and the Lord's Supper and the baptism and absolution has gone on in the church of that day.
The other emphasis, and here we only have a minute before we have to conclude our conversation, Dr. Tomasz, is that Timothy would be faithful in particular in his doctrine, passages like adhere to a pattern of sound words, study to show yourself a workman approved, rightly handling the word of truth, watch your life and doctrine closely, thereby you will save both yourself and your hearers. It echoes again and again in Paul's advice to Timothy. Does this lay the emphasis for every pastor and indeed every Christian as well, this careful adherence and faithfulness to sound doctrine? 1 minute.
Yes. Certainly, Paul has filled Timothy with exhortations to not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord. It's interesting that even though he might be thoroughly connected to Paul, Timothy was bound even closer to Jesus. And so that word that was first proclaimed by our Lord is now on the lips of him. And so what does he speak about? His own purpose, Christ's own purpose, the grace which was granted us in Christ Jesus for all eternity and has been revealed by the appearing of Jesus Christ. We dare not, even in though these days we have Paul and the sons and pastors who work underneath him, think that any one of these three men would not have given, even as Paul had later on, his life for the message of Jesus, for which they were appointed, sent out, and teachers of his gospel. They weren't.
Dr. Harold Tomasz is our guest, associate professor of Greek and the New Testament, Concordia University, Wisconsin, and Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Tomasz, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
You're welcome.
Dr. Harold Tomasz. When we come back, Brian Goodow will be our guest. He's a regular guest here on the program, a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. The Academy Award nominations are out. We'll find out what those nominations hold right after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What's the relationship between the Oprah Winfrey Show and Pop American Christianity? How have psychology, emotionalism, and feminism left the church unmanned? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article for the next Issues, Etc. journal titled Church is for Girls. And you can get a free complimentary copy of the next Issues, Etc. journal by calling our resource line 1-800-737-0172. Plus, Pastor Tim Pauls has written an article titled The Problem of Pietism. Should subjective feelings trump objective truth? Find out with the next Issues, Etc. journal, 1-800-737-0172. The Wittenberg Trail feature details how Vicar Stephen Parks came to a Christ-centered understanding of baptism and the Lord's Supper. 1-800-737-0172. If you enjoy Issues, Etc., the radio show, you need to get the Issues, Etc. journal. 1-800-737-0172.
Evolution, is it just a modern idea?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the book The Genesis Solution. Well, Ken, is the theory of biological evolution a modern idea, as some folks would have us believe?
Well, many evolutionists today would argue that evolution is a modern idea. In reality, this is just one tactic of evolutionists to make their theory appear more credible. On the flip side, a creationist worldview is criticized many times as being a product of our so-called less informed ancestors. The truth is, evolutionary thinking has been around for centuries. Consider the beliefs of the Mayan culture in Central America. Beginning around 600 BC, the Mayans believed that a rain god created humans by adding to and modifying his previous creations. First, the god made rivers, then fish, then serpents, and last humans. The Greek philosopher Empedocles, almost 500 years before Christ, argued that chance alone was responsible for the entire process of the evolution of simple matter into modern humankind. Many people today have the wrong idea about evolution, such as believing Charles Darwin invented the theory. You know, while Darwin did popularize a certain view of evolution, evolutionary ideas really go way back in time, to the Garden of Eden, in fact, when the devil's temptation to Adam and Eve was that they could become or evolve into gods.
The institution of the family was ordained by God himself in the Garden of Eden. Find out more, including how Genesis relates to the topic of gay marriage, when you go to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Have you ever watched a commercial on TV and thought, what are they advertising? Then 25 seconds into a 30-second commercial, they finally mention the name of the product. Such advertisements are using a technique called emotional transfer. The point of the first 25 seconds is to simply make you feel good. Then they hope you will associate that good feeling with their product the next time you see it at the store. Charmin and Little Debbie love to use this technique. Teach your children that cute babies and cuddly animals have nothing to do with the quality of a product. Pray with your children that the Lord would make your family good stewards of His gifts. He loved you enough to die on the cross for you. He will also give you wisdom in how you spend His money at the store. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Here's an AM 850 KFUO salute to our day sponsor on this Wednesday, January 26, 2005, Anita Twenhoffel. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in loving memory of her brother, Fred Nacky, who has gone on to be with the Lord. Once again, we say thank you to Anita Twenhoffel of Carlisle, Illinois, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsor.
An excerpt of the music from The Passion of the Christ, Oscar nominee for Best Original Score. That's the soundtrack, including the music, for those of you who don't know what an original score is. The music was compelling, but there was so much more compelling about The Passion of the Christ, including its box office take. It is a bit of a wonder that it did not get anything more than just nominations for several minor categories. We're going to be talking about the Oscar nominations. They're out. Brian Gadawa is with us, screenwriter from Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Another surprise, Fahrenheit 9/11, which made a big stir and made a lot of money, especially for a documentary, did not get nominated at all. Brian Gadawa, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Are you surprised that The Passion of the Christ got only minor nominations?
No. No, I'm not, but I am surprised that Fahrenheit 9/11 didn't get on there anywhere, you know?
Now, the paper, at least the local paper here, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, kind of attributed this to the controversial nature of both of those films, and the Academy was trying to steer away from controversial things. Therefore, they both kind of got panned in the Oscar nominations. Do you think it's a fair explanation?
I don't know. Maybe so. I mean, you know, on the one hand, there's a lot of dark corners of religious bigotry in Hollywood, so that would explain why they wouldn't like a movie that shows Jesus Christ as the ultimate victim of their hatred, and, you know, so I could see why they wouldn't pick that one. But yeah, you know, especially in light, but it is surprising about not picking Fahrenheit 9/11 in light of the fact that Hollywood, gathered around him, last year when it came out. So it was,
that was a little bit surprising. So, yeah, maybe it is something about the controversy more than I would think.
Can you explain to me what the Academy of Motion Picture Sciences, or whatever it is? What is the Oscar organization, and what do these awards really mean in Hollywood?
Well, I don't know that much about it. Probably not much more than you.
Well, I picture a bunch of guys with thick glasses that look like they look like, you know, movie moguls from the 1940s.
No,
sitting around a big table as the Academy, and they're the ones making all these decisions. How are these decisions, nominations, and eventually the Oscars awarded?
No, people can. Of course, you can get in the Academy by winning an award, being nominated too. But levels, like writers, actors, and directors, have different sort of qualifications that allows them to become part of the Academy, and it has to do with productions and how many and how often and stuff like that. I don't know the exact details, but yeah, it's not really a circle of people sitting around a desk. So it is people of the industry who are voting on their peers.
And after the nominations are made, are there really campaigns to get the awards themselves?
Oh yeah. In fact, one of the big problems is as the last couple of years, because of DVDs, they've had a lot of fights over getting screeners out to people because of the nature of DVDs and how easy they are to duplicate illegally. Studios were really balking on getting the DVDs out to the people, and that's really the best advertising of all, is to have giving a free DVD of movies to the Academy members, and then they'll watch it, and that's your best advertising to get the votes, you know. But the problem was, is of course, you know, they had people who were pirating those before the movies even released on DVD, long before, and so they had this real big legal battle, and the studios were balking at getting the DVDs out and debating about whether or not they're going to do it, etc. So there's, you know, That's been a real big issue. But also, you know, there are advertising campaigns in the trade magazines. You know, most of the rest of the world doesn't see this stuff. But, you know, if you get Variety or Hollywood Reporter, you see all these big ads and all these millions of dollars that Miramax and different companies pour into their little babies that they want to get awards for. And it's all about just getting the attention, getting in the front of the face of those who are going to vote.
Let's talk about Best Picture. Aviator, Finding Neverland, Million Dollar Baby are among the nominees this time around. Tell us about each one of these movies. Aviator, to begin with.
Yeah, Aviator. Boy, Aviator is, of course, you know, the epic about billionaire Howard Hughes and how he declines into the breakdown of obsessive-compulsive disorder. So it's sort of an epic about a tortured soul. You know, it's one of those things. Hollywood likes to make a lot of those movies of tortured souls, and I think this year there's a lot of them up for nominations. So, but you know, it's a huge epic. It's visually beautiful, you know, done by Martin Scorsese. I think that it had some really great acting by Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Blanchett, Kate Beckinsale. Real fine acting in there going on. But you know, I think that ultimately that it's a film that sort of focuses on Howard Hughes in an external way. It shows his breakdown and all the does a very good job of showing visually how the man broke down over time, you know, from the little twist, you know, little jerk in his hand to the point where he couldn't even be in a room with people, that kind of a thing. And it does a good job of sort of chronicling the downfall, right? But for my own self, I thought it was sort of shallow in terms of focusing more on external behavior, you know, rather than going into the spiritual origins of how he and all those around him were really obsessive compulsive spiritual disorders, if you know what I mean. That's the nature of biopics, is sometimes they focus more on the chronology of what happens rather than going deeper into the characters and trying to, you know, it's more about, well, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, rather than really going into, you know, the problem that the character has is a metaphor for a bigger issue in life. And that's what more fiction movies are able to do, but people sometimes get hampered by that. I think Aviator is hampered in that it doesn't really explain to us where it came from, and it doesn't really go into the craziness of the world that he was a part of. You know, he was romanced by the shallow glamour of Hollywood, And really, there's an obsessive compulsive disorder for you right there embodied in a whole town, right? And so he sort of missed an opportunity to get into that, the depth of that insanity, I guess, if you will.
Clint Eastwood is nominated for Best Director, and the film itself also is up for Best Picture, and that's Million Dollar Baby. Clint Eastwood had Unforgiven back in 1992 that I thought was one of the best movies ever made, and he proved himself to be an excellent director. Tell us about Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah, and I think Million Dollar Baby is an excellent film. Quite frankly, I watched the film, and I was moved by it, deeply watching it, although I deeply disagree with the worldview in the film. It's I think...
What's it about?
Well, it's about a story about an old boxing trainer played by Clint Eastwood, and he basically reluctantly agrees to train a young hillbilly woman who's trying to get him to teach her how to box, you know. And she ends up becoming a knockout champion, and the story is sort of about a father-daughter substitute relationship going on. They both find in each other a substitute for the daughter that he couldn't reconcile with, and she finds a father figure in him. So it's sort of a beautiful family substitute type story going on there, and they both find redemption in each other over their own faults, and it's a very, you know, sort of a beautiful story, and I'm not really a sports fan guy, but I enjoyed it. You know, it dealt with boxing really interestingly, and Morgan Freeman plays a great sidekick, and so it's very deeply moving. But then, you know, and I'm going to reveal the twist here, because one of the few, along with one of my heroes, Michael Medved, who he's one of the few critics who's revealing the twist, because he feels that we have a moral obligation to do so, because ultimately this movie turns into a pro-euthanasia or a pro-assisted suicide film. One of the characters ends up becoming a quadriplegic in an accident, and so the movie turns around and basically becomes a story about assisted suicide and how it's right to do so because of the quality of life that's being lost in a person, you know. So it's sort of an emotional trick that gets played on people, and in that sense it becomes a rather polemical story, you know, and it sort of loses its heart for me.
Couldn't it have been just as good a movie had they left out the ending and the twist that was so distasteful?
Yeah, I personally think so, because some people feel it was cliche boxing movie and all this. I didn't. I felt it was very good. I thought all the characters were great, and a lot of emotional emotional grit going on there. You know, they have Clint Eastwood plays a Catholic, and he keeps going to church, and he argues with the priest all the time because he has all these. It's sort of like he's boxing with God, if you know what I mean. And that's fine. It shows a man struggling with God, struggling with the issues of life. Problem is, when he finally gets to the point where there's a decision on what to do with assisted suicide, he, quote, walks away from church and from God entirely because God doesn't give him the answer that he likes. You know, and, of course, the answer is thou shalt not murder. And so it's a big, strong emotional appeal that we should assist people by killing them. And this is, of course, a very emotionally strong thing, but it's ultimately an immoral worldview. And for that reason, I have to discredit the film and say that it's rather humanistic and nihilistic, much like his previous movie, Mystic River. So I don't know why he's got such a pessimistic outlook on life, but so be it.
We're talking about the Academy Award nominations. Brian Gadawa is our guest. He's a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. You can read his movie blog on the web at Gadawa.com, G-O-D-A-W-A.com. You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Brian, one other for the best movie, and that would be Finding Neverland. Tell us about it.
Finding Neverland is a magical tale about the man who created Peter Pan, James Barry. It takes place in 1900 in England, and it's basically about Barry, who's basically a man-child who hasn't grown up himself, you know, writing stories and such. And he meets a widow and her five boys, and he falls in love with the boys. And the boys are struggling with the death of their father, and so he sort of brings his imagination and creativity, brings redemption into these boys' lives. And one boy in particular named Peter, who's become cynical as a six-year-old or so. He's already cynical about life, and he doesn't have any creativity. And Barry sort of brings him alive and brings back imagination and innocence to this young boy. So it's a coming-of-age story about innocence, facing your mortality, a very beautiful very well acted. I mean, when I saw it, I knew instantly. Months ago when it came out, I knew instantly it was going to be up for Oscars, and Johnny Depp might even win because he's really quite brilliant in the movie. Kate Winslet is great as the widow. Unfortunately, it has a romanticist worldview, which means that imagination takes the place of God. The artist, you know, or the writer is prophet. Art replaces religion, and creativity is salvation. So it has this sort of idea of creativity, imagination becomes the thing that you have faith in and that you believe in. And they literally use religious metaphors in the film to communicate this. So you see that creativity is a replacement for religious faith. And so that's the downside of the movie that I wouldn't really encourage it. But on the other hand, it does really make you it brings you alive to the power of creativity in a world that, you know, we're deadened by our scientific modernist viewpoints, and we've lost our heart and innocence and creativity, imagination. So I think on that level it does a good job, but on another moral level it's sort of it's more romanticist than it is moral, you know.
Here are Best Actor nominees, and I want you to give me your pick and why. Best Actor, Don Cheadle for Hotel Rwanda, Johnny Depp, Neverland, you just mentioned him, Leonardo DiCaprio for The Aviator, Clint Eastwood for Million Dollar Baby, he acted and directed that one, and then Jamie Foxx in The Tribute to Ray Charles, Ray. What's your pick and why?
Well, I got to say, me personally, Johnny Depp, because the range of his character that he goes through is just brilliant. Clint Eastwood is pretty much just playing his old curmudgeonly self, you know, that he plays in other movies. It's a good job, and I love Clint Eastwood's character, but he's just Clint Eastwood. And what were the other ones you remember? I unfortunately didn't get to see Ray yet, but I suspect that he has a strong possibility. From what I've seen on trailers and what I've heard, Jamie Foxx does a brilliant incarnation of Ray Charles, and I think if that's true, then he probably should win it just because of his ability to capture that great legend that we're all familiar with.
And he's not only acting, he's singing too, which is amazing.
Oh, I wasn't sure about that. He actually does the singing too?
I think he does a major portion of the singing.
Wow, that's great.
All right, here are the girls. Annette Bening for Being Julia, that's a film we haven't talked about. Catalina Sandino Marino for Maria Full of Grace. We've got Imelda Staunton for Vera Drake. Hilary Swank for Million Dollar Baby, playing opposite Clint Eastwood there. And then Kate Winslet for, this movie was one of the strangest and thought-provoking I ever saw, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. What's your pick?
Yeah, well, you know, the first few ones I didn't even see, so I can't say. But, you know, seeing Hilary and Kate in those movies, Hilary, I fell in love with her watching that movie. I mean, Million Dollar Baby, she captured the spirit of hopeful, optimistic, yet uneducated Southern hillbilly girl that you just fell in love with. So I think if she wins it, she deserves it. But Kate Winslet was really quite great in that quirky, eccentric, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So I think that if she won it, she could probably deserve it as well. My vote would probably go for Hillary. I wouldn't vote for the woman who is up for the Vera Drake movie. Vera Drake is a movie about an abortionist, and so it's of course a pro-death movie that supports the belief that we should murder our unborn children. So I wouldn't vote for anything about a movie that someone who endorses genocide like that. So I couldn't in good conscience. And, you know, Maria Full of Grace is about a heroin addict. I didn't see it, so I really couldn't comment on that one.
The film that everybody's talking about right now is Sideways.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah. It's definitely, you're right, everyone's talking about it, critics and Hollywood, people love it. To be quite honest with you, I'm not sure why. I mean, I can see there's definitely some great acting by some seasoned actors in there. Thomas Hayden Church has a comeback. Paul Giamatti plays himself, but he fits the part well, and Virginia Madsen is just wonderful. So there is some great acting, and there is some very clever writing. Mr. Payne, who wrote it, also wrote about Schmidt, which is a brilliant story as well. So definitely some good writing, good acting. A story about two guys who go on a road trip up to wine country in Northern California before one of them gets married, and you know, Paul Giamatti plays a writer who hasn't published yet, and his friend Jack is an actor, and he's a womanizer, and this womanizer gets him into trouble because when they fall for some women, he's getting married in a week, and he's fooling around with a woman, and not only that, but several women, and so he causes all these problems that Paul, the writer friend, has to cope with and deal with. And so it's like it's a farce, a comedy, you know, they get into trouble and they've got to get out, and it's got some really funny moments for some more adult, more mature viewers. And so I think that it's just a good, strong, unique, unpredictable package. It's not your formula movie that you go to and you can predict everything. And I think for that reason, it's got a lot of uniqueness and originality. Unfortunately, I think that the worldview of the movie Sideways is very humanistic and very immoral. I mean, ultimately, you've got a main character who struggles throughout the whole movie with a friend who's unfaithful to his girlfriend, who's soon to be his wife, and he's an entirely unloyal or an untrustworthy person. And the hero never cuts off his friendship with him. He stays with him to the end. You'd think that by the end of the story, he finally gets wise and either confronts his friend or does the right thing and cut him off because he's not a true friend. But he never does. And so the movie sort of reinforces that loyalty to friendship is more important than morality. And for that reason, it's a very morally unsatisfying film for me personally.
The one category that's pretty new, a couple of years old, is Best Animated Feature Film, and that's becoming an increasingly large category.
Yeah.
We've got The Incredibles, Shark Tale, and Shrek 2. Which of those is your pick?
Oh, The Incredibles, by far. I mean, I've seen them all, and I love them all. But everything Pixar does is great. The Incredibles, a very pro-family film about, you know, it's such a unique little idea, too. You know, they're these super a family of superheroes who have sort of put away their superpowers because through the years, people kept suing superheroes when they would get hurt being saved by a superhero, you know. So because of our litigious society, superheroes have sort of stopped helping people because they can't afford to anymore. And I think that that's a great social statement about our culture. But that's, of course, not the true heart of the story. The true heart of the story is this family, you know, and as they battle the bad guys, who's this a superhero bad guy himself, it's all about family loving one another, helping one another, using our unique gifts to help others and to help one another. So it's a very, very strong pro-family movie. It might not be suitable for real young children because it's sort of very intense, and it's got, you know, a little level of seriousness with guys with guns in it, you know, more so than some of the lighter stuff Pixar has done, you know, like Finding Nemo or something. But it's still got real wonderful values and just a great, enjoyable time. So I hope it. I've seen Shrek 2 as well, and Shrek 2, I hope Incredibles wins. Shark Tale and Shrek 2 had a little bit of an under agenda beneath the stories that I didn't care for. Shrek 2 is, of course, you know, the playing off of the fairy tales that it did in the first movie, but it sort of reemphasized that theme about how different people have different likes and dislikes. It's sort of a relativistic worldview that says, you know, you can have different likes and dislikes of different kinds of people, and basically what that becomes is a metaphor for homosexuality and transsexuality. They have, you know, Pinocchio wears women's underwear in the story, and so you've got this, you know, an underlying agenda in Shrek 2, and I think there's that same exact agenda in Shark Tale, even though they both have some good morals in them. You know, Shark Tale has some good things about loyalty and friendship and, you know, honesty and stuff like that, but it also has sort of an under agenda about, you know, the need to accept the people who are different in our society, which, of course, we all agree in that, but what it really is about is wanting to gain normalization and acceptance of homosexuality and transgenders as normal in society. And I think that can be an annoying agenda that bugs me.
Brian, the movie for which you wrote the screenplay, To End All Wars, is available at video stores like Blockbuster. We heard we were with a big group of pastors this last week, broadcasting live up in Fort Wayne, and some of the pastors were talking about To End All Wars. They didn't even know that we had you on as a guest.
Uh-huh.
But they were talking about, they're saying, I would show this movie to my congregation. They were saying, why should someone rent To End All Wars this weekend when they go out to Blockbuster or their local video palace?
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, go rent it because it's a great movie. Yeah, you know, I do. I still get lots of letters and emails from people just thanking me and telling me what a meaningful experience people have had watching the movie. And it, of course, blesses my heart to be that I was allowed to be a part of something that God has used, a movie that is about POWs in World War II and starring Kiefer Sutherland and Robert Carlyle. And it's sort of like a Schindler's List for the Allies. You know, it's about men experiencing atrocities under the Japanese and how they find redemption and spirituality in the midst of it. People are still email me with their encouragement from watching that movie, and it makes my day, it makes my week, it makes my month sometimes, you know?
Well, Kiefer Sutherland obviously has had some phenomenal television success with the series 24.
Yeah.
And I just saw him on Inside the Actors Studio, and that's all they wanted to talk about. Do you think it's going to help To End All Wars?
Oh, really? That's all he talked about on...
Well, you were talking about 24. Everybody wanted to talk about 24. And yeah. I'm thinking, you know, here's a guy whose star is obviously not only on the rise, he's firmly fixed in the movie star heavens.
Yeah.
Do you think that'll help To End All Wars?
No, I don't. Well, I don't think so, because actually when we were struggling to get distribution for it a few years ago, he had just won the Emmy, and then the series was good, and it didn't seem to help it in terms of getting a good theatrical distribution. But now that it's on video, yeah, everything helps. You know, word of mouth. You know, people fall in love with him, and they start to look, what other movies has he made? You know, and then they'll see that. So, and personally, I think I like Kiefer Sutherland in certain roles. I think it's his best performance of his life. So if you do like Kiefer, you'll definitely like the movie.
Well, that's good to hear, and I imagine Kiefer would be happy to hear it, too.
Yeah.
Brian Gadala is a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Brian, thanks for your time and for being our guest.
Thanks a bunch, Todd.
Go to his website, read his blog on the movies, Gadawa.com, GODAWA.com, Gadawa.com. Tomorrow on the program, oh, by the way, before we get to what's tomorrow, go out tonight, and this is what we do. I always go out Thursday night because, of course, Friday, you can't find anything. Go out Thursday night, find it on DVD, To End All Wars. If you're a Kiefer Sutherland fan, if you listen to Brian Gadawa here on Issues, etc., you will be pleasantly surprised. Tomorrow on the program, the fourth discourse in Matthew's Gospel, we're going to talk about life in the kingdom of heaven. Dr. David Scare, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January Discourses in Matthew, will be our guest. And we'll also talk to Dr. Bill Weinrich of Concordia Theological Seminary about the early church father, St. John Chrysostom. That's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.